Good morning. My name is Rachel, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the National Pork Producers Council Media Briefing conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Thank you. Mr. David Herring, President of National Pork Producers Council, you may begin your conference.
Good morning, and thank you to everyone for being here. I'm David Herring, President of National Pork Producers Council and a producer from Wellington, North Carolina. With me today are NPPC President-elect A.D. Rowe, a producer from Wisconsin, and Vice President Jen Sorensen with Iowa Select, and Neil Dirks, NPPC CEO. We also have NPPC staff here, including Nick Giovanno, the head of the D.C. office. Let's take a moment and have NPPC staff introduce themselves. I want to start.
Chloe Carson, Manager of Digital Communications for NPPC.
Jan Kovich, one of NPPC's staff veterinarians and Director of Science and Technology.
Andrew Bailey, Science and Technology Legal Counsel.
Jim Monroe, I'm on the communications team here.
Danielle Seitz, Director of Congressional Relations with
NPPC. Michael Smith, I'm the Systems VP and Legal Counsel for Domestic Policy.
I'm Neil Dirks, I'm the CEO of NPPC.
Hi, I'm Liz Legstrom, I'm Chief Veterinarian for NPPC.
I'm Maria Ziva, I work on the trade team.
Nick Trudano.
Thank you, guys. This week, more than 125 pork producers from around the country were here the past 2 days for our spring legislative fly-in, meeting with their congressional representatives on issues of critical importance for U.S. pork. I'll take just a moment to summarize the focus of these discussions, and then we'll get to a question and answer session. Trade remains our top issue. We asked members of Congress to support ratification of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada's trade agreement, preserving zero-tariff pork trade in North America for the long term. We also highlighted three issues related to the health of the U.S. swine herd and our industry. We asked members of Congress to support 1. Appropriation funding for 600 new agriculture inspectors for U.S. Customs and Border Protection to further strengthen biosecurity at our borders and to prevent an outbreak of African swine fever and other foreign animal diseases. Also, we ask for USDA implementation of the 2018 Farm Bill as intended, including development of foot and mouth vaccine bank, and moving regulatory oversight of gene-edited livestock from the FDA to the USDA in order to keep America first in agriculture. Gene-edited livestock holds tremendous promise, including improved animal care, reduced need to use antibiotics, reduced environmental impact, and improved production efficiency, and the United States' risk of falling behind because of the FDA's lengthy, costly, and impractical regulatory framework. Finally, as you probably know, the USDA is in the process of developing a new gypsum rule. We don't think a new rule that addresses the pork sector is necessary, as it is a highly competitive market and pork production is the most innovative sector of the overall agricultural economy. Our producers asked their representatives in Congress to oppose any legislation or regulations that interferes with the pork producers' rights to freely enter contractual business relationships or otherwise restrict producers' ability to sell and packers' ability to buy livestock. Those are currently our top issues. We can talk about them in more detail or discuss other pork industry issues on your mind. I'll open it up to your questions now. We have folks on the phone, so we'll alternate between questions in the room and from the phone. Before posing your question, please introduce yourself and identify your media outlet. So, Jim, if you want to, we'll start with the questions.
Rachel, we're going to open up the Q&A. If you want to give the instructions one more time,
And then we'll take one from the room to give people the time on the phone to tee themselves up.
Sure. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Any questions in the room?
Sure. Jerry Hagstrom from the Hagstrom Report. I'm wondering if you have a reaction to the stories about the high price of pork in China.
Well, we think it creates tremendous opportunity for producers in this country. It's a unfortunate for the Chinese consumers and the Chinese producers. They're having a lot of issues managing African swine fever, but we have seen reports of extremely high prices for their consumers. I think pork prices were up almost over 40% in the last 30 days. And the reports that we are reading, and nobody knows this totally, information is sometimes not as reliable. But when you look at the China as a whole, they produce 50% of the world's pork. They eat almost twice as much pork in their diet as we do here in the United States. And when you look at the losses of their herd that we are, based off the information we're receiving, it's creating a hole of animal protein, not only in China, but throughout the world. So it should create opportunities for farm families and pork producers in this country and also other countries.
I agree with David. Maybe just take off the 16% retaliation tariff that they put on there, give pork producers here in the U.S. a chance to get in there and help their citizens of China.
How much do you figure American pork producers are losing at the moment because of these tariffs? In the Bloomberg story this morning, they're even despite the tariffs and the trade war, and you've got a 47% increase in the price of pork in the last month in China. There was a debate within the ARC people in China who talked to Communist Party officials, say there's a debate within the Communist Party about things are so bad we maybe have to start importing U.S. pork despite this trade war. But so far, how big a loss do you reckon this has been for U.S. pork producers that you've been shut out of that market more or less while they're experiencing tremendous prices?
$8 per animal, and that number.
Even with the
that number's probably could even grow depending on the extent to which the United States is able to serve the Chinese market. So that number comes from an economist at Iowa State University, Dr. Dermot Hayes, who's pretty well known here in Washington and on Capitol Hill and at USDA. He's been doing forecast and impact analysis for National Pork Producers Council since the mid-90s. So we're really comfortable with that number. And when you look at that number in connection with the number $12 per animal, which was the impact of Mexico's retaliation to the metal tariffs, you can see that our sector arguably has been one of the most impacted by the trade disputes. You know, the question going forward is to what extent will the United States benefit from this unprecedented opportunity in China? You know, as David said, the analysts believe that up to 50% of Chinese production is out. That's the biggest pork producer in the world. So China's obviously going to import more pork, right? They already, you've seen the articles, they're concerned about food price inflation. They're going to import more pork and more meat protein. The question is, who's going to benefit? Under, going back 2 years ago or further than that, under those economic conditions, without the trade frictions, unequivocally, it would be the United States would be the principal beneficiary. But given the uncertainty surrounding the U.S.-China trade dispute, we just don't know. And no, you know, nobody knows. Clearly, there's upward pressure on global pork and meat prices worldwide, because if you pull that much meat protein out of the global meat complex, creates upward pressure on prices. But who's going to benefit and how much, we don't know. Our great concern is the longer this goes on, the less we benefit, the more places like Brazil and Europe and competing areas, they expand their production, they get more of the Chinese market, and then that's competition, presumably, that we've got to compete with over the long haul. So, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty. Nobody really knows, other than there's a big protein deficit in China. Under more normal economic circumstances, the United States, the U.S. pork industry, unequivocally, would be the biggest single beneficiary. The Chinese are going to have to import more pork. We know that, right? We don't know that pork is the single biggest component of the CPI, but we know that pork is a very significant part of the consumer price index in China. So they're going to have to import more. The question is, where's it going to come from? Who's going to benefit it? And folks, we just don't know the answer to those questions.
You don't? Do you have any data on increases in exports from Denmark or anywhere in Europe?
Nick, before you respond, Nick Giordano speaking right now. If we could identify ourselves and we're answering.
Yeah, sorry. This is Nick Giordano on MPPC staff in Washington. Yes, third country exports of pork are up to China, and I think we're going to see now exports of pork and other proteins increasing to China. Again, the question for the U.S. pork industry is, you know, how much are we going to benefit? Clearly, there's upward pressure on prices. There's some benefit. Are we going to get the huge benefit that we otherwise would? Because this is... for pork producers globally, this is an unprecedented opportunity.
Would you describe this as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity
yes,
for you?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. What's your view on that, Mr. Harris?
It is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And the pork producers in this country would like to have the level playing field and be able to take that opportunity. Like I said earlier, it's a terrible situation in China, not only for their consumers, but producers, but we can help mitigate their losses, and we would like that opportunity.
As AV said, if they were to roll back the punitive tariffs, right, so 60% on most pork products, their punitive Chinese tariffs of 60%, and that's on top of the MFN rate, the normal tariff rate of 12%. So for a collective 72%, they roll that back, we're going to be able to ship a lot of pork there. Obviously, that's very good for the U.S. pork industry, very good for the United States, because we can single-handedly put a huge dent in the U.S.-China trade imbalance. But I'd argue it's very good for China, because China doesn't want food price inflation. So we understand the complexities of the U.S.-China trade dispute, but we think we're in a unique position where we can really help both countries and somewhat diffuse the problem.
Rachel, do we have any questions on the phone?
Yes. The question comes from the line of Jackie Fatka from Feedstuff.
You had mentioned
your line is open.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thanks so much for taking the time today. You mentioned one of your priorities is about the gene editing, and I know that there's been some recent reports anyway about some of the problems with the hornless bovines and how it contaminated the bacterial genes. Can you guys talk about any concerns that you're hearing from folks on moving forward with USDA regulating the gene editing animals, or are you guys any different spot than you were earlier this year or within the last year on this discussion?
Liz, you want to take that?
Dan, excuse me. Yes, Dan Kovich, Director of Science and Technology. Certainly, the situation with the bacterial DNA that was reportedly found in the genome of that was edited cattle is concerning. Now, I will say that there are a lot of applications of gene editing. There are a lot of techniques that are used to edit animals, and there's a lot of applications that don't involve any insertion of new genetic material at all. And those are the ones that we're primarily looking at when it comes to the pig. The other thing that we really need to be clear about is that we are not asking for this to be deregulated in any way. An issue such as was found in those cattle is something that would have been found by whatever agency is regulating this technology. You know, that's part of the basic review that any agency would undergo to make sure that an edit was safe and effective. Our issue, again, is not deregulating this technology, asking for any less scrutiny, but simply what agency is going to regulate it and how they're going to regulate it.
Let me come at this a little bit differently. This is Nick Giordano. Either FDA has to take a radically different approach to the technology, or it's got to move to USDA, which wants it and should have jurisdiction and oversight, just as they do on the plant side. And the track that FDA is on here is going to result in the United States losing this industry. Make no mistake. And we simply cannot have that happen. So we've made it very clear to this administration, they know they have the authority to move it. USDA wants it. We're extraordinarily frustrated with the FDA. This needs to happen. Now, on the one hand, this isn't a today issue in that it's not like all these technologies are ready to come to market. And we certainly understand there will be consumer acceptance issues. But the threshold issue here is oversight and regulation. And the approach that FDA is taking is simply not science-based. It is not science-based. It is beyond precaution, and it will result in already Australia, Brazil, Canada, China, other places are ahead of us. We are not going to stand by and lose our technological lead to other countries. So we've got to see this. Either FDA has got to do an about face, or USDA has got to have authority over not just the plant side, but the animal side as well.
Thank you. This is now Aoyama, a correspondent of the Asahi Shimbun, a Japanese newspaper. Last month, in Paris, President Trump and Japanese Prime Minister Abe reached a consensus in core elements, including agriculture, and the U.S. and Japan are now rushing to reach a deal around the end of this month, in which the U.S. pork industry, it is likely, could gain a TPP-like access to the Japanese market. First, could I have your response to the alleged deal and this move from the both sides?
We're very, U.S. pork is very excited about the opportunity for this deal to get consummated. Japan is our largest value market. They've been a great customer of U.S. pork for many years. We were on the outside. We were at a disadvantage with other trading partners because they were actually getting less tariffs on their pork products than we were. So we're very excited. It's one of the greatest news tidbits we've had, and we can't get the deal done fast enough.
Okay, and if the U.S. administration has not withdrawn from the TPP, the U.S. Pork industry would have gained the same level of success with other competitors from the beginning.
Right.
So what do you think about this?
Well, we're excited about this new opportunity. We don't know all the details of the opportunity. It sounds like they're going to be very good for U.S. pork. But our administration decided to go another way originally, and today we're very excited they've changed course. So, you know, Jen, you got anything you want to add to it, or Nick?
Oh, we'll hear from you specifically
about part farmland,
how that
would be impacted. Well, we're all great volunteers, just so you know that. But to me, we want support. We want the ag deal. We're disappointed with TPP. Why it happened, I'm guessing, had nothing to do with pork farm.
You're disappointed with the withdrawal
from TPP. So then we went on. We wanted to have the TPP. It's gone. That's right. So now we're fighting for an ag deal, and we want ag deal. But just know that just because there's an ag deal on the table, we want a total comprehensive package eventually. But we had to have this before we lost our share of pork market in Japan, and it was hurting us tremendously.
I was talking to Secretary Perdue yesterday. With what he said, I wish it had been Lighthizer, but he said he expects beef and pork to get even better deal than was in TPP. Have you heard any details about this?
We have not heard. We don't know the details of the deal. We've heard the same thing you've heard, and we're going to be very happy with it. I'm tickled to death we're even close to getting a deal. But to answer your question today, we really don't know the details.
What about the... Perdue also said that he's sure that you'll be put on a level playing field. In other words, you'll be starting where the other countries have gotten to up to now, if that makes sense.
That is great news, because okay, that's where we would like to be.
Okay.
Rachel, any questions on the phone?
Yes. The next question comes from the line of Corinne LaRue from RFD-TV.
Go ahead. Hi. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for taking my question. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah,
I hear you.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I had a question in regards to the USDA development of a vaccine bank for foot and mouth disease. I mean, where's the progress on that?
Liz, would you take that?
Yeah, this is Liz Weigstrom. Earlier this week, USDA issued what they call a sources sought notice. And that notice is to identify potential vendors that would be interested in bidding on a vaccine bank. That notice is open for 30 days. They will evaluate the replies to that notice and then issue a request for proposals or bids. We still don't know how much money out of the entire farm bill package will be spent on a vaccine bank. We're really encouraged that they have actually got the source of thought notice published. We're anxious that that process move forward. And what we hear is that sometime early next year, they may be in a position to start issuing some of the initial contracts. But it has been a slow process. We're pleased to see that it's moving forward, as well as I think two to three weeks ago, they issued a request for proposals for $10 million to be used for the prevention and preparedness grants and or the National Animal Health Laboratory Network. So that's all three legs of our three-legged stool in the Farm Bill, and we're happy to see there's finally being progress made toward utilizing those funds as Congress had directed.
Okay, and just a quick follow-up question on that. You spoke on timeline about how by early next year, hopefully they'll be able to roll out some of those contracts. But, I mean, where is your guys' satisfaction in regards to the timeline of this entire bank being established? I mean, are you guys happy or do you think it's being a little bit of a slow process?
Well, of course, we would love to have instant gratification and have it all today. We realize that it's going to take time for whatever manufacturer that would receive those contracts to ramp up production because it's going to be a large amount of vaccine. We realize that going into the Farm Bill process. And so, well, we would have, you know, liked to have it happened the day after the farm bill was signed, we are encouraged to see the progress we've made now.
Okay, thank you.
Mark Heller at the E&E News. I could ask you a little bit about hurricanes and flooding and the effect on producers, because every time we have a hurricane come up the East Coast, we hear about the issues in North Carolina particularly, and I've been there after Florence and saw so many damage. What kinds of things are you all doing to help producers accept and understand the risks and the dangers involved there? And do you think the federal government should be doing more, USDA, to encourage certain practices that would help farmers prepare for things like this? And of course, there are always buyouts. We've seen buyouts that's a process that hasn't been completed. And I wondered what you think about continuing on efforts like that.
I'll answer that question because unfortunately, I've lived in Hurricane Alley for the last 20 years from North Carolina. Quickly, to get you updated on the last storm, Dorian, there was no impact whatsoever on swine farms. We actually, the day after the storm, we sent people up in aircraft. They videoed and photographed farms. No impact whatsoever. We've had, I think, to date, 8 different municipalities that have discharged human waste into our watershed or our rivers. No discharges, and this is, I'm quoting the Department of Environment Quality in North Carolina, no impact from swine farms. The swine industry in North Carolina have had over 100 farms over the last 12 years that were in floodplains, bought out, and closed. They've also, even in the hurricane 2 years ago, Florence, or maybe a year, a little over a year ago, Department of Environment Quality in North Carolina came out and said basically no impact from swine farms. All our impact from waste runoff was from the municipality. So the industry in North Carolina has had issues called problems from hurricanes, but most of it's been because of power outages, road closures where we had trouble getting feed and fuel to animals, even 2 years ago, getting labor to the farms because of all the flooding. But our industry the North Carolina industry has really worked together, and it is a testimonial not only to the farm families there, but the companies that work there and produce pork, to the preparedness and the ingenuity they've been able to create to mitigate these damages from hurricanes.
Okay, can you make a comment about some of the misinformation?
We actually went up last week or the day after the hurricane and wanted to document what really had taken place. And it was documented well with photographs and videos because of these animal activist groups that publish and create false accusations. And luckily this time we were able to get ahead of them and stop that from happening. So our local newspapers in the state actually published the truth this time.
Because they weren't misled.
They weren't misled. So,
well, and they were informed in advance. So what? You know, one of our big sticking points here is that time and time again, the activist groups get out there. They put out
false. This is Michael Prometheus.
Michael speaking with the National Pork Producers. They put out very misleading or false narratives in the press this year. And I'm going to call them out. The Environmental Working Group said that there were 132 swine farms that failed in Florence. There were not 132. Swine farms that failed. That is a false lie. It is a lie. It's no other way to describe it. We had 3 lagoons that had some damage, and the lagoons there in Florence mostly were hit, ones that were damaged were hit with storm surge, not with the volume of rain. There was 40 to 50 inches of rain, so these lagoons, they work hard to manage the lagoon. by law, they have to keep 19 inches of space from the top of the manure level to the top of the lagoon. They're generally at 30 inches or more. Going into Dorian, they were up to 36 inches. So there's no risk of these overflowing. We had another 23 or so where the floodwaters rose so high at junctures in streams that the water overtopped, but no manure left those lagoons. They were designed to hold things out. We see pictures time and again in the press where they can't find farms that have failed, like Waterkeeper, Environmental Working Group, or NRDC is telling them. So they run pictures of other operations, and they claim their farms. And you know, even last week, we had this happen. There was a picture of a house with a garage, and one of the organizations here ran that picture in their publication and claimed that was a hog farm. And it was not a hog farm. And we spoke to the reporter. We warned the reporter, this kind of stuff happens. Make sure you don't do this. And go, oh, we'll never do that. We'll never do that. And sure enough, the next morning, there's a picture of not a hog farm labeled a hog farm.
We do give that outlet credit for taking
yes.
the picture down.
Yeah.
The other thing I would add to it is the North Carolina swine producers work under the most stringent environmental laws in the country. And they've been in place for almost 20 years. So we have created a tremendous amount of records that solidify what they're doing, and they're doing the right thing. And it's hard to combat false accusations. But the records are there to prove that NC Pork and the pork families are doing the right thing.
There are more records and more detailed records on swine farms in North Carolina than you will find on any farm anywhere else in any other state in this country. And they're required to keep these records. They take, you know, they take daily readings. All of those records get turned. Well, first of all the farms in North Carolina are permitted. So unlike other states, they are all permitted. They all have extensive regulatory oversight. They take the readings. They're all reported electronically to the state. Anyone at any point in time can go on to the state webpage and can pull all of the records going back 20 or 30 years. I mean, 20 years.
20 years.
20 years.
I would say confidently there's 20 years worth of hard records. The other thing, and if you'll look at states that are growing in population, North Carolina is one of the fastest growing states in the U.S. If we had issues with environmental problems from livestock or pork, I don't think that would be happening.
Often, go back to this picture, because the picture thing, it really hurts the farmers to see this, because they're doing a great job trying to prevent damage, to fix their farms, to feed people. Up until Florence, most of the pictures we saw running were always pictures that were 20 years old. They were all taken during the 1990s, and the press would rerun these pictures. After Florence, after Matthew, they started running. They seem to, it'll, the Washington Post has done this. It's not one media outlet. It's all of them. They run pictures of, we've seen municipal wastewater treatment facilities run labeled hog farms. We have seen, houses labeled hog farms. We've seen poultry buildings labeled hog farms. We have seen horse farms labeled hog farms. You name it, and if it's there in eastern North Carolina, they're going to run a picture of it and flood it and call it a hog farm, when in fact, the hog farms that were at risk, as David pointed out, have been since 1996, they've been in the process of shutting them down, buying them out, and moving them out of the historic floodplain.
Rachel, anything on the phone?
Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star and the number one on your telephone keypad.
Sorry, get away.
There are no questions at this time. Please continue.
Okay. I started on the line about buying out farms. After Florence decided last year, Governor Cooper proposed a rather large restoration package. I remember the North Carolina Agriculture Department said, we might have some number of millions of dollars to buy out some of the lower-lying hog farms or large livestock farms in low-lying areas. And I've lost track of what happened. And was the money ever appropriated?
I may be speaking out of turn. I'm not sure, to answer you honestly.
You're going to ask my information.
Yeah. You know, dear Florence, we had areas of eastern North Carolina had a 1,000-year flood. I mean, unprecedented. But yet, after extensive work by the Department of Environment Quality in North Carolina, they came out with a statement that our biggest environmental impact was from municipalities, and the hog farms had a very small impact on it. So I wish I could answer your question, but I don't know for sure.
I've had trouble getting the North Carolina state officials to follow up on that, so I'm hoping to do an end run.
But one thing for that, the people that own these facilities and the people that work on there, the pork producers of this country, we care about that. I live on my farm. My kids live on my farm. They drink the water. They eat the pork. That last thing, I'm on a fifth-generation farm. Last thing anyone's going to want to do is have something happen. We do our very best to try not to have that happen.
I'd like to go back to the trade issue. You said that that China should take off these 60% retaliatory tariffs, but they are in retaliation for actions that the Trump administration has taken. Do you think the Trump administration needs to do anything at this point?
I think pork is a unique situation because the Chinese really need it. They're the biggest producer and consumer in the world, and the estimates are 50% of the production is out. So to me, this serves Chinese interests. Why have a 60% punitive tariff on something you need? We're typically the number one global supplier of pork in the world. We've got a product that's affordable, second to none in terms of safety and quality. Seems like a pretty good idea. If there's a product that you can rally behind and smoke the peace pipe while you continue to negotiate, should be pork. And as I said, it could single-handedly, pork could put a huge dent in the U.S.-China trade imbalance. So I don't think we need to get we would love, and our position always has been, come on, U.S. and China, resolve this thing. We want to get back to being able to export pork, not being under a punitive tariff. But I think there's a great case, and hopefully the Chinese recognize this, to lift the tariffs on U.S. pork. I think it would be viewed, obviously, very favorable by our industry, but more important, by the United States government, and the two sides could continue to negotiate. We'd all like this thing to be resolved tomorrow. I just don't know if that happens. It's gone on for a long time. So I think, unlike virtually every other product that's caught up in this thing, we're different. And they really need pork now. And food price inflation is a big deal. So we're hopeful that the Chinese government will roll back the 60% punitive tariffs.
On USMCA, speaking of trade, it really just, for you guys, maintains kind of tariff-free access that you had under NAFTA. But you guys have been a very outspoken supporter of the agreement. I'm curious, what do you think you would gain from the agreement when it sort of just maintains the status quo from NAFTA?
Well, we would maintain our largest volume market.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's most important to us. And we've had a great relationship with the Mexicans. Between Mexico and Canada, that's about 40% of our exports. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir.
So just maintaining that relationship and keeping that opportunity to trade with Mexico and Canada on a level playing field, on products they want, that's what's important to our producers.
Just a point of clarification, the 40% of exports, is that volume or the volume?
Volume.
Volume.
That's volume.
But the one thing, to get that deal done, we need insurance. you know, on my farm, I want to grow for my family and stuff like that. If I don't know the next day something's going to happen in Mexico or Canada that's going to put, you know, put more tariffs on my product, do I grow? Do I know that? So just, we need to get that done now, as soon as possible, for that reason, and get back to the way it was.
That was A.D. Rock for folks on phone.
You know, trade's been incredible for U.S. pork. We went from a net importer of pork in the early 90s to we're exporting a fourth of our production. And the thing that's so great about that, it gives rural America opportunities. It gives the opportunity for those kids coming back from school in rural America, opportunity to stay in rural America and grow and create jobs and create network. And our industry has watched that. I mean, we've grown over the last 20 years, 25 years, because other countries desire safe, affordable pork protein. And it's been a great story for United States and rural America, and we want to continue that.
Rachel, do we have any questions on the phone?
Quick question. Why? I mean, why wouldn't you be able to continue it?
Why wouldn't be able to continue it?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, do you see an active threat to NAFTA?
No, not today. Not today. But when we had the 232 metal tariffs on us, we were losing market share. And
but presumably that had nothing to do with NAFTA. I mean, you could have a new NAFTA and still get 232 tariffs at a later date.
I would agree, but from our position, we want a level playing field to be able to compete anywhere in the world. We feel like U.S. pork is the lowest cost producer and the safest, most affordable product, and we want an opportunity to compete on a level playing field.
Sir, I was being artsy. The real question I'm asking here is, are you worried that Donald Trump will pull out of NAFTA if he doesn't get U.S.?
I think the question is, are there a lot of people in the United States with concerns about NAFTA? Now, our industry really liked it, but there are a lot of people, including a lot of people right up here in Capitol Hill, that have concerns. So that's the reality that we have to face, right? It's not just the administration. There have been lots of voices, I think, as we all realize, since the inception of the NAFTA, questioning the value. We now have a replacement, I think, that addresses a lot of those concerns. We need to get it finalized. Going back to AB's point, it's about certainty, right? And we just got done talking about China. There's tons of uncertainty. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if we're going to get the amount of U.S. pork moving to China that we normally would, right? We want that certainty with Canada and Mexico. As David said, it's 40%. Of our volume of our exports. We want that certainty. That's really important. And I think they're getting close to a vote, and I believe there will be a vote this year. The votes are there. It's going to pass.
I think we have a question on the phone, Rachel.
Yes, the next question comes from the line of Janine Otto from Illinois Agri-News. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for the media conference today. And I guess this question would be for Nick, and kind of follows up on one of the audience questions. But it just seems like there hasn't been the pressure from NPPC on the administration and on the U.S. trade side to continue talks or to find a resolution. And I'm just wondering, you know, what the approach is. It seems like all the pressure is on China, but there are two players in this game.
Well, we don't always talk publicly about our discussions with the administration, but you can rest assured that they've heard very directly from not only MPPC Washington and staff, but from producers around the country. I mean, our leadership have been in for multiple meetings. And I think, look, the administration understands that this has taken quite a toll on the industry. But I think
By the same token, we all realize that these are deep and complicated issues with China. I think in spite of the fact that it's taken a lot of money out of our producers' pocket, they've been extremely patient. We're hopeful that this thing gets resolved. As I just said, one way, I think, to help diffuse the problem and to start driving things maybe towards a settlement would be for the Chinese to eliminate their tariffs on pork.
Mike Dorian, Bloomberg, how much of your losses do you think from trade aid?
Not a lot. I mean, it's the trade aid is appreciated. It's significant, but in terms of our losses, no. I mean, China is at least $8 per animal, and again, these are numbers from Dr. Hayes of Iowa State. The Mexico metal retaliation was $12 an animal. That was $20 off the price of every animal sold in the U.S. So, no, it doesn't make up for it. It's appreciated, but no, it doesn't make up for it.
Mike, this is Jen Sorensen. I think the trade aid that went directly to the food bank has been widely appreciated by those families who have been unable to purchase pork because protein is expensive. And so I would say that move has been very positive for people. I mean, we have to remember that one out of five families in the U.S. are still feeding here. And so that's been a really good story to tell as a result of the trade tax, the trade mitigation package.
Well, pork producers have been at the tip of the spear when it comes to trade deal and what's been going on. We've been hit, I believe, as one of the hardest groups. But you ask any producer out there, they appreciate the money that's coming, but all they do is want to sell their steak and the best quality pork in the U.S. across the world. That's what they want.
Folks, I apologize. I have another commitment. Thanks for being here. And you obviously are a good aunt since I said nothing, so. Which makes everybody else happy. So thank you.
Travel safe.
Don't be fooled. He's the best CEO we can have.
Notice he says that while I'm still here.
One in the room?
All right, I have another question. I've just come back from the Good Food Conference in San Francisco, which is for plant-based and cell-based protein industries. I don't hear as much about pork in this field as I do about beef and chicken, except, I guess, for breakfast sausage. And I just wondered, what is your view on these two industries?
Here's what I call plant-based protein.
Did you have that already in advance? Do you want to hold it up and have me take a picture?
Oh, no. No.
Jen, you want to get out of the picture?
I stand behind the president.
We feed them corn and soy. That's plants. Where I came from.
Yeah. What about?
Who wants to talk about it?
You want to talk about it then?
Yeah. I mean, these products have been around for a long time. Obviously, Jankovich. Obviously. We are seeing a move where they're increasingly mimicking the appearance, the texture, the taste of real meat products. Because you could say that, imitation is the purest form of flattery. What we really want is a level playing field. And particularly when it comes to labeling nomenclature, we want to make sure that there's clarity in terms of what these products are called. And that the naming conventions that the USDA's Food Safety Inspection Service has put out in terms of naming and product standards are respected. I mean, certainly there's a lot of room for diverse products, and we believe our product stands up. but there's got to be clarity. The other thing I think that really concerns us when it comes to these products is they're kind of wrapped up in a halo of good health, sustainability, you name it. It's not a one-size-fits-all. There's many kinds of animal protein there. There are a lot of different kinds of plants. These products are often heavily processed and contain a multitude of different ingredients. Got to be clear how they're made, what's on that ingredient label, to ensure that level playing field and that a fair comparison is made, not just in terms of nutrition, but in terms of sustainability, in terms of affordability, and so forth. So, you know, the reality is we understand those products are out there. We want a level playing field because if we think the playing field level, our product can compete and compete well.
Now, just a follow-up here. I hear the real motivation behind the cell-based protein industry, that's the use taking of a few cells and multiplying them, is that people don't want to give up bacon. That this is the thing that if you ask vegans, what do you miss about meat? It's bacon. What does your industry think about producing bacon or other pork in this fashion?
I think that it's still too soon to decide. There's been a lot of hype around the cell cultured protein, but you'll notice that despite all the hype and attention, these products aren't out there. Unless they're not on the shelves, they're not being made available to the research community to look at them. They're not being made available to regulators to evaluate them. So I think it's a long way off, and it's certainly a long way off before there'll ever be a product that can approach the, let's just call it the beautiful complexity of a slice of bacon. All the things that make it, as you said, the one meat product that no one wants to give up.
But we're for technology and innovation. Technology and competition are the backbone of our economy. As Dan said, it's about labeling. It's about a level playing field. You know, these folks need to be under the same regulatory microscope that we are, okay? We just had a detailed conversation about how poor North Carolina pork is just all this attention, and most of it unjust, right? Well, how about just some very just, fair, hard-going attention on these other sectors? We're for technology. We're for innovation. And you know what? The market's going to determine this stuff. And I think your question was, you know, would some of our producers consider producing this way? You know what? That's a long way off, but the market's going to determine that. We just want a level regulatory playing field.
And, you know, as Nick said, you know, technology is the key to our industry, key to other industries, how we grow and how we advance. It's also the key to why we're so sustainable. That, you know, they're marketing these products with that allegedly as sustainable alternatives, but we don't know what their true footprint is. We do know from the pork industry that we are incredibly sustainable. We are, you know, the low hanging carbon protein choice, and we're 1/3 of 1% of emissions in the U.S. on historical data. We're just getting new information that has come out here from a recent board study that shows.
And that 1/3 of 1% is from the Obama EPA, correct?
Obama EPA.
1/3 of 1% of U.S. greenhouse gas. 1/3 of 1% Obama EPA.
U.S. greenhouse gas emissions from the pork industry.
We compare with like chicken and beef.
The point is, we're really proud of what we've done, and what a lot of people don't consider is that modern pork production has resulted in a significantly lighter carbon footprint, significantly lighter.
And adjusted to marketplace conditions. So we have new research that just came out from from the fourth floor. They actually just sent out a notice today, but we haven't done a full press release on it. But it was focused on air emissions generally, and we knew we had technological, we had processing changes over the last 10 years, that with the advent of the RFS and volatility in the core market, we need to get more efficient in how we fed our animals. And what we have found is that totals, because we're more efficient in feeding the animals, our total nutrient loads in the manure, that is what is left over from the corn and the soybean, is down anywhere from 25% to 79% in farms. And that then will translate into lower ammonia emissions, lower air emissions, lower climate emissions, lower methane production.
Obviously we're concerned about the South Ulster crop field. I just want to be clear from our perspective, until the people developing these products make them available to the scientific community and the regulatory community and both the product and their process, it's really premature for us to be having this conversation and for them to be making any claims about their product being cleaner, safer, less antibiotics, and so forth, because it's really still inside of black box that no one has been able to penetrate.
I'll just tell you, what I was told out there is the people they're letting taste this are the investors, and they have to sign waivers for liability because these are non-approved products. But, yeah, it's interesting that the investors have more access to this information than the scientific regulators or the academics or anybody.
Next question.
Hannah Monick at Inside U.S. Trade. Going back to trade for a second, I'm curious, if China doesn't get resolved by the upcoming election, for instance, it looks like it's going to be sort of a long-term thing, at least for the time being, what are you hearing from your producers or from you guys in general? What sort of role this might play in the election? What sort of role trade in general might play, whether or not, you know, if USMCA is passed or if there's a deal with Japan, but China sort of is the big market that is yet unresolved and doesn't necessarily look like it will be resolved in the near term?
So for corn producers here in the U.S., we understand, you know, in Wisconsin, it takes me 18 months to get a permit just to build a farm. We understand that there's a long view here. You know, absolutely, we want it done as quickly as possible. It's just like we said earlier, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And honestly, in China, there's people over there that potentially could die if they don't get enough food. So producers here in the U.S. just want a chance to get in there, and we believe we make the best, best product, most quality here in the world. We want a chance to get in there. But we understand the long haul. And we just talked about GE, animals. You know, we understand that that's going off overseas. You can go do these things, and you can eugenate modified animals. So we understand technology going other places, and understand that that needs to be taken care of with China.
Right, 2020 is a political eternity away. I mean, it's look, producers want these problems fixed, I think, but we're benefiting from the protein hole in China. Again, the question, I think if it wasn't for China's misfortune in getting ASF, there'd be a lot more angst in the industry. Not that there isn't angst. I mean, they said $8 off the head of every animal, but there's a huge protein hole in China. Now, we're going to benefit, and we're starting to benefit already. The question is how much. So I think, you know, it's a good question, but November 2020 is a long way off.
So when you say November 2020 is a long way off, are you saying you don't know what pork producers will be thinking?
No, I don't.
They have to endure this, or are you...
We don't know nobody.
And you don't know whether...
No, nobody does any more than they know who's going to take the Senate or, you know, is the White House going to flip? We don't know. But we'll have, as we get closer, we'll probably have a better idea. Things hopefully China settled by that.
Next question.
But I would be correct in reading that as both unknowable how long the trade dispute will last, but also unknowable whether the current patients, which polling data suggests is pretty high, that most agricultural producers have in America, there's not been much affection from the administration that that might or might not last. If that could go through another year of bad times because of the trade crisis. I'm good. Am I interpreting it correctly?
I don't think there's an answer to the question. Let's see how things look. There's a lot of producer frustration, but producers have been very patient. And I do not think that China is going to be the only prism by which they view this administration or make their myriad voting choices. And it's just would be totally speculative to say. I think we all know that producers tend to be Republican. Where are things go in the next election, you know, vis-a-vis our producers, I really don't know.
Do you think you're actually out there a producer? Probably you see other producers every day.
You know, you got to understand the timing of everything. The U.S. pork industry has been growing at anywhere from 2 to 3% over the last 5 years. You'd ask, why are they growing? Well, they're growing because there was demand for their product. And so we enter into these trade insecurities or trade wars when you have an industry that is growing. So that puts angst on that industry and creates a lot of uncertainties. But from what I've seen so far, echoing what Nick said, is the producers think they're thinking long term, and they've been very patient. I'm not going to tell you all of them have been very patient. I mean, because I have business with some that weren't. And if your livelihood or your farm was on the line and you thought you were going to lose it, you probably wouldn't be very patient. But as a whole, I think the pork producers in this country understand what's happening. And I'm not trying to speculate, but I think their patience is a sign that they believe in what's happening, and they think when they come out of the other side of it, things will be better.
Take one more in the room. There is one.
Well, if nobody else has a question, I'll go back to the meat alternatives and ask, do you have any reaction to all these big processing companies declaring, as they did last week, they are no longer meat companies, they are now protein companies? This is JBS, Purdue, I can't remember all the others are there.
Pork is the number one meat consumed in the world, and that's not changing anytime soon. Most of you probably don't know that, but pork is number one in the world. We sell a heck of a lot of U.S. pork here in the United States. It's really darn good, and I think we have a very bright future, and what we got to have is the same rigorous scientific review of so-called alternative products, the same rigorous federal and state oversight, the level playing field. That's all we ask. I mean, this is the United States. People take risks. Some things take off, some technologies take off, some things are just fads and they burn out. Who knows? But all we ask for is a level playing field, the same for the media to ask the same probing science-based questions that they ask about us to us to alternative products. That's only fair and right.
I think too, this is Jen Sorensen. We've always stood behind the idea of a consumer's right to have choices, and especially here in the U.S. I mean, all of the different choices they have for different products is a good thing, and we've embraced that. But what's important to us is going back to Dan's comments and Nick's comments around what we don't like to see is mistruths or misinformation around labeling. Or, you know, you need to make it clear to consumers the product they're buying and being honest and forthright about what the product is. And those things are important to us as producers because, you know, we're passionate about the quality of our product, the safety of our products. And like Nick said, people love pork. You know, Americans love pork and you know, other countries love pork too. And so we want to make sure that we have a level playing field.
So if cell-based protein is commercialized, should it be called meat or pork?
There are, again, a fairly complex body of regulations and naming standards, nomenclature, that the USDA's Food Safety Inspection Service has established. And yes, it is going to need to fall within that framework. So there is a definition of a meat food product that will fall into. Is it pork? That remains an open question. We would say no, because in terms of the standard identity for pork, that is a muscle cut that comes from the carcass of a pig. And cell culture protein will never be able to fit that definition. Will it be able to be called something, for example, a cell culture protein from pork cells? I think we'd all be fine with that, you know, and obviously, as I said, it's premature to have these conversations until we know what they're producing and what the product is. So to answer your question, yes, it will be within that meat food product category. But I don't think we see any way forward where it is just pork or, as I already mentioned, the Holy Grail bacon.
As a consumer, how would you like to be, you know, what you're eating that really wasn't bacon if they called it that? That
they didn't but come they found it is bacon, and they say that if you don't call it meat, that's mislabeling.
Again, that meat food product definition, there's room for everyone to play in there. But when it comes, I mean, the other way to look at this is you don't walk into a grocery store and buy something that's just called meat, right? You can buy a meat lover's pizza. You know, you can find the word meat in products, but you don't just go in there and buy something that's sitting on the shelf and it just says meat on the label, right? There's a lot of room to play around. But we fully embrace the USDA's FSIS taking regulatory oversight of processing and labeling of these products, which means it does fall within that umbrella. There's no question about that.
Bottom line?
Yeah.
Ain't nothing but the real thing, baby.
That's a good note to end on, I think.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And before we end, I'd like to mention there's going to be another MPPC media briefing planned for October 1st. Is that correct, Jim?
That's right.
To provide more information on the critical need to quickly implement the FMD vaccine bank. In the provisions of the Farm Bill. We'll be joined by other farm groups and an expert from the academic community who has studied the consequences of an FMD outbreak in the United States. So stay tuned for more information on this briefing, and thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.